The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Good morning and you're very welcome to the show. And I have to say, for a bank holiday weekend, there's a lot going on and there's a lot to get stuck into in the papers today. It looks like interesting times ahead. And I say interesting times in the way that the Chinese say interesting times when they curse you and say, may you live in interesting times. So, right, Business Post, new vaccine deals to deliver 20 million doses by the end of 2023. But possibly more interesting and germane to people in that story, IBM and Salesforce have been hired to develop a passport app that could facilitate easier access to international travel. This is by the Irish government. And greater privileges for those who have been vaccinated. The Business Post understands the government is looking at whether or not people can be required to show they're vaccinated when gaining access to sporting events, concerts and indoor hospitality venues. The Mail restaurants plan to sue government. I think this was Adrian Cummins of the RAI on Katie's show yesterday. There's a great quote here. There's a lot of there's clearly a lot of fractiousness around the country and locally and stuff. But one cabinet member apparently said to the Mail, "Neffet are against drinking, so there's no rush in that body to open hospitality. And since we're no longer standing up to Neffet in any way now, there's no chance there'll be any indoor dining in Ireland before July." So that's the mood among some TDs out there anyway, or among one anyway. The Sunday Times, COVID supports payout to roll on until autumn. So the PUP and the wage subsidy scheme until at least September. And Michael McGrath has an interview in there, but like just this is continuing to cost a lot of money. The Greens back Byrne over Chew for by-election. This is Clare Byrne and this is the Dublin Bay South by-election, and that by-election is going to be just the soap opera that the nation needs at the moment. And they're saying in one of the, I think the Mail, that it could happen sooner rather than later. The Sunday Times also saying over 12s to be offered single shot of Pfizer jab in Britain. That's another new interesting territory we're going into. The Sunday Independent, so they're continuing that Kantar poll of 2,500 people all over the island. About a United Ireland. So the headline today is two-thirds say United Ireland vote risks return to violence. This is despite the fact that most people, when asked, favour United Ireland. But as is pointed out by Éilis O'Hanlon and other people inside, it seems to be quite an aspirational thing and it's not clear how much people have thought through the consequences of it. The Sunday World has an ex-heroin kingpin and killer, Abraham Turner, and he has found God and he now prays as he cleans clients' homes. The Sun on Sunday has another crime story about, you will remember, Derek Delboy Hutch. Well, he's set to walk free in July and apparently it's feared he could seek revenge for the murder of his older brother, Gary. The Irish Sunday Mirror has Christy Dignam on the front page, and Christy, who, as we know, was having a rough time anyway for the last number of years. Christy has had a pretty tough 6 months as well with a fall and various other things. So wishing the best of luck. And the Observer, and I think the Observer is pointing up something that is now screaming at us and that we really can't ignore. Two pandemics, they say, as we ease up, virus sweeps the planet's poor. And they have on one side a picture of that experimental rave in Liverpool in the UK, 3,000 people raving it up in an indoor venue, no masks and stuff. And on the other hand, they show us the picture from the inside of a hospital in Delhi. So that's the broader picture that puts everything in perspective. Our panel today, Richard Jacob is the owner of the Idaho Cafe in Cork City. Dr. Anna Rose Pryor is a consultant microbiologist in Tally University Hospital. And Fionnán Sheehan is Ireland editor of the Irish Independent. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
Fionnán, we were just talking global there, but going back local, I think there's a sense in one way among some people that this is all over by the shouting. But it seems like the shouting could be pretty loud and could go on for a long time. A number of rows brewing across the papers today. But one of them, an interesting one now, in the Mail. So we have the context of this, which is Donegal got very miffed at Tony Holohan telling the dogs in the street up there to cop on. And now I think support's being put into Donegal. But the Mail is suggesting that there's a feeling throughout the country among local representatives that different counties should be treated differently.
Yeah, so we saw this last summer where individual counties had to be put upgraded in terms of greater restrictions being put in place when their cases spiked. So you're now looking at a scenario where Donegal has 295.9 cases per 100,000 of the population, but Kerry only has 19. So if you are putting restrictions in place, why would it be fair to upgrade Kerry when they have such a low rate because the level of infection is so much higher in Donegal? So the preference now is, one of Micheál Martin's commitments the other night was, once we come out of the lockdown, we don't want to have to go back in again. That's the certainty that you're providing to the public and to businesses alike. But one of the weapons in the arsenal there is to say to an individual county, well, if things continue there because of an abuse of the restrictions, or simply because an incident has happened that has resulted in a spike in cases, that you will be individually locked down. Now, within Donegal, it's quite interesting. People are saying South Donegal is not as bad as North Donegal, but when you're getting into kind of micro lockdowns of a particular region, that's going to be very difficult indeed to get into. So we're still at the point where you're looking at individual counties itself.
Is this a situation whereby now that, I suppose, the, you know, when the fear is there, we're all in it together and nobody, there's not a peep out of anybody. As the fear subsides, are these TDs now starting to think about their own local areas and going back to face their own constituents, and whether there'll be a summer in Kerry and Cork and Mayo quite low, Clare quite low, and they're going to start coming under pressure locally? So the conversation gets more disparate again, does it?
Well, it's a variation on a theme that we've seen for quite some time during the lockdown itself, and as restrictions have eased. Why is the following shut down? Why is retail shut down but supermarkets are open? Why are cafes open but pubs are closed? And people saying, well, I don't really understand this. So obviously a local TD is going to bang the local drum and say, well, we need to protect our area, and the problem isn't here. So if NPHET have reached a point now where they believe that the country as a whole can reopen, well, then they're still going to have to keep an eye on the individual pockets. Now, there is other things you can do. You don't just jump and immediately say, right, the first thing we want to do is lock down a particular area. You put more resources into that area. You put more testing centres. You obviously have a role for the Gardaí and public health. And also on the leadership side for political representatives to emphasise to people the importance of abiding by
which we're seeing happening in Donegal. Yeah. But I notice you're focusing there on locking down some places more rather than opening up other places more. Anna Rose, does it make sense? I'm looking at the map here in the Mail, and I'm looking at a lot of green down around the south coast and up much of what you might call the Wild Atlantic Way. Does it make sense that we start breaking this down more locally, and like Kerry, 19 cases, that's per 100,000 over 14 days, I'm assuming, which is like, it's practically a ninth, a tenth of what you're seeing in Dublin.
So absolutely. So look, I suppose it's important to say the situation is still quite unstable at the moment. So if we're talking about micro lockdowns, I think that's when you get to a point where things are more stable, that it's easier then to have these pockets. Whereas I don't think any county at the moment, you know, is very far from potentially becoming, you know, having more outbreaks. And particularly the UK variant has contributed to our instability, or, you know, in that regard, and that very quickly an outbreak can take off given its transmissibility. So I think when the country as a whole gets more under control, those outbreaks in smaller areas can be close down with that. So the county measurements as they stand at the moment, they're quite crude measurements. Obviously, as Fiona mentioned, there's lots of inter-county variability. So that has to be borne in mind as well. I mean, the situation in Donegal, it's really only pockets of Donegal. And all you need is a few large outbreaks to give the whole county incidence to appear quite high. So at the moment, regional outbreak or regional restrictions are, you know, wouldn't be... The situation is just too unstable, I think, to allow for regional restrictions. I think at the moment it is a case of we're all in this together, and none of us are too far from having a bigger outbreak than we would like.
Okay. Richard, what would be the view down in Cork, do you think? You're on 47.5 here. I'm assuming this is the 14-day 100,000, but anyway, you're on about a quarter, say, of where Dublin is at, and you're obviously substantially below the national average. Are people in Cork feeling that they should get some kind of a dividend here?
Well, I think it's the first time that Cork has been happy to be at the bottom of any list. but look, I think it is tricky once you start breaking things down. You start trying to introduce things on a micro level, because even at the moment, it's the whole country. We still have that. We're in it together. And if you start breaking it down, say, in Donegal, and start saying, well, this North Donegal is higher risk than South Donegal, whatever line you put, you're going to go through somebody's garden and somebody's going to say, come up with the, oh, that's not fair. This town isn't, shouldn't be in it. This one should. And as soon as people start questioning a policy, it's, we've lost it. And at least when it's just one big turd with one brush, there is a hint of in it together. But I think as soon as we start breaking it down, then people will always come up with some example of why something that looks just a bit stupid.
Richard, on this, and obviously this is about the hard decisions. Now, you picked out Conor Skehan's article in the Sunday Independent today. And his basic point is that I think it can be summed up in his line that it's on the mountaineer's descent when most of the accidents happen. What did you take from what Conor Skehan's saying today?
Yeah, he had a very good point going back to the days when currency was made of real gold and real silver, that everyone used to fake coins, paint gold and put them into circulation and take the real coin out. And after about 40 years, all the coinage was fake and useless. And he compared that to governments making populist decisions and said that if we always keep making the decisions, it's the easiest decision to make. Eventually, all decisions made are the lazy decisions. And he kind of turns around and said, look, there are sometimes hard decisions to make. Now, I don't want to be a hypocrite because I've railed against some of the hard decisions that were made over it. But if you kind of look, maybe with the mandatory hotel quarantining, I was shouting back in January that we needed to bring it in. But really, it should have been brought in months before that. And what was brought in was a response to the fact that 95% of the population were bellowing, we need mandatory hotel quarantining. And something was kind of cobbled up to keep people happy instead of put together to keep the country safe. And I think that's something we have to be wary of.
Yeah, but then a mandatory hotel quarantine that keeps the country safe is what they have in Australia. And I think increasingly people are wondering, do we want to live like that? Mandatory hotel quarantine, they seem to want to get rid of it as quickly as possible is the vibe you'd be getting, isn't it?
Yeah, but you do have the difficulty that the public health officials can say, well, look, the variants are still out there. On the one hand, people say, oh, this is a terrible system. But immediately there's a clamour last week to put India on the list, although there are no direct flights here from there and a minimal number of people travelling.
And I think if they did, they came through UAE or other places that were
They'd have to come through Heathrow. So it's a bit like everything else. There's a desire to remove the restriction until it becomes necessary, and then there's a demand to say, well, why wasn't this in place all along?
yes. So they can't win, really. Now, another row going on this weekend is the whole row around hospitality. And Rose, can I ask you, as the specialist in the room, what do you think about what we're doing around hospitality? Does it make sense? Is it too much, enough, the inconsistencies in it, etc.?
Yeah, so look, I think we've learned a lot over the last year about this virus. So it is a new virus. It's evolved with various mutations. It's become more transmissible. We know a lot more about ventilation. We know a lot more about high-risk situations. So regarding hospitality, I suppose a lot of hospitality, it's indoor-based. So bars, restaurants, they're indoors. So we know they're higher-risk scenarios. So it'd certainly be moving too quickly at our current rates. And remember, our national rates are still quite high. They're not as low as they were last summer. And like I said, it's a virus that's more transmissible than the virus we had last summer, the way it's evolved. So to move forward too quickly with, you know, escalating to indoor hospitality would certainly be a step too far. So certainly the public health guidance as it stands at the moment and the plans for the relaxation of restrictions, I think are cautious, and they're rightly so cautious, knowing what we know. And as I said, we're coming off a high baseline. So we're not going to be too far from running into trouble if we escalate things too quickly.
OK, so you think appropriately cautious at the moment. Richard, where do you stand on this row that's on the front of the Mail now, where we see that people, restaurateurs are saying, why are hotels being allowed to do indoor dining when we can't do it, and now talk of a court case and everything?
I think the whole indoor dining versus outdoor dining, the first thing is that 80% of restaurants, bars, indoor dining is the only way to actually have a viable business. So it's kind of the al fresco summer is being used as a fig leaf of kind of just saying, no, it's great. The country's reopening outdoor hospitality, which is fine for 20% of us. Like, we're delighted. We have a lot of space outside. But for 80% of Irish restaurants, it means nothing. And I think it's funny that we're just talking the black and the white between indoor and outdoor, and there's no mention at all of ventilation. If you go through the Fortune Ireland COVID safety charter, there's 29 pages of information for a restaurant about reopening. Page 29 is about ventilation. And I think it's just so simple that if you open every single window, like if you burn toast in your kitchen and you open the window and you open the kitchen door, the smoke goes out the window and the air is cleaner. And it's as simple as that. It's not going to make indoor dining 100% safe, but it's going to make it an awful lot safer. And there's no emphasis. Nobody's talking about open our doors, open our windows. It's okay. Just in or out.
Do you feel there could be indoor dining maybe sooner than, I know it's vaguely talked about July at the moment, if that we were to be a bit more creative about it and if we were to think about stuff like ventilation?
I do. I'm going to put a huge caveat and say that people's safety comes first. And speaking just for myself, I'm going back into my business with my wife and with three amazing staff. None of us will be vaccinated and some of our customers won't. And that's our priority. Our priority is to keep people safe above everything else. But I just think, and it's almost too late now, a year into it, but I think people should be told, open all your windows. Like at the moment, you can go into a small shop or a cafe doing takeaway and all the windows are shut and the doors are shut. And it's as simple as that. It's not going to make it 100% safe, but it's going to make it safer.
Okay. I have on the line now Professor Molly Byrne. Molly is Professor of Health Psychology in the School of Psychology at NUI Galway, and she's an expert on motivating behavioural change. And Molly, I know you've been advising the Department of Health during the course of the pandemic. What do you make of where we're at now in terms of the opening up? Does it seem appropriate?
Morning, Brendan. Very nice to speak with you. So in terms, I suppose, of where we're at, Brendan, I think a key thing is just acknowledging, I suppose, the year that we've all had and the challenges that we have come through. I mean, we're now at a time of 18 weeks, following 18 weeks of level 5 lockdown. And I think many people have found this third lockdown, you know, the most challenging of all. So I think it's really important to start with remembering and acknowledging, I suppose, the extent of what we've come through. I think we're in a very positive place. I mean, the vaccination programme is going well. So, you know, we're slightly above the EU average. 28% of our population have at least one dose of the vaccine compared to 27, which is the EU average. So, you know, I think in Ireland for us to be above the EU average is, you know, very impressive. I think we can be very happy with that. I think the public are largely on board with how the public health restrictions have been going. I mean, we don't like them, but I think there is a broad awareness that they are needed. And I think throughout...
But, Molly, I wonder, is there a question there, though, that they really had to give people a break at this stage? I mean, Philip Nolan said as much yesterday on Katie. He said that people were getting ahead, so that they had to, you know, get back in step with people.
I think that's absolutely right, Brendan. So, I mean, the data would suggest that, you know, public mood is up. People are reporting more enjoyment, happiness, hope, and boredom is down. And also people are thinking, yes, we want now a little bit more moving forward. So I think it's absolutely appropriate that we look now towards finding really low-risk ways that are going to be high gain. They're going to feed into what we prioritise. So meeting up with families, allowing outdoor activity. I think we can look at ways to do these safely. And I think this is what the current easing of restrictions is aiming to do.
Is there a danger, though, Molly, that, and have we seen it a bit in the last few days, that, to quote the soccer pundit, they think it's all over and that people are kind of thinking, OK, well, grand, you know, they give them an inch and they'll take a mile.
I think that is a real risk, Brendan, and that causes me a lot of anxiety. I mean, I think we do need to look for these low-risk ways to ease the fatigue that a lot of us are feeling about the pandemic. But we also need to, and Anna Rose referred to it there in terms of levels of the virus are still very high. Yesterday, 569 cases reported. So we need to move super cautiously. And in particular with the B117 variant, you know, which is more transmissible. So our 569 cases now is maybe not comparable to what that would have been last year. So I think the key thing, Brendan, is that that message of it's all over, we're out of it, we're grand now, is we cannot have that message going out. We are not grand.
Okay,
we
and
are
do
in
you
a
think
good position, but yeah.
Okay, sorry, Molly. Do you think them is the messaging good right now, or do you, is it clear? And because I actually think that I've started to think over the weekend from talking to people that it was a mistake, for example, to announce everything last week and then say to people you'd wait a week, because a lot of people just A, didn't get that you had to wait a week, or B, decided, well, sure, if we can do it next week, we can do it now anyway.
Well, I mean, I think you're always going to get some people who will do that, you know, the anticipatory behaviour. So they will change their behaviour in advance of kind of when they're in inverted commas allowed to. So you will always have a little of that. I mean, I think it's appropriate to announce what's coming up. I think it's great for people to be able to plan as best they can with all those uncertainties. I certainly think with the messaging at the minute, you know, I've been listening to people like Philip Nolan, and I think he is absolutely emphasising the importance of, you know, that still the behaviours that we all know well, social distancing, keeping our contacts low, washing our hands, ventilating, these are all critically important. These are not all off. But there are things that we can now, so, you know, outdoor activities, meeting with a person outdoors, walking, you know, there are definitely things that I think they can be done safely. And I think okay. We need to explore those and learn from those.
Okay, Professor Molly Byrne of NUI Galway, thanks a million for that. Fionnán, I noticed today Hugh O'Connell is mentioning this and Danielle Byrne's mentioning it in the Business Post. We're moving into a new era of messaging, apparently, which is going to be about personal responsibility. I feel we've been here before with the era of personal responsibility was tried, but is there that sense that we are moving into this new phase now?
Yeah, there seem to be, again, going back to what you were talking about with Molly, an abject fear of bringing in a lifting of restrictions ahead of a bank holiday weekend, because everybody would go pure stone mad altogether, and they think that everything has been lifted. So, hence a delay. There's, you know, they've been accused for the last 12, 14 months of Big Brother, big government coming in, taking over the country, a nanny state developing. And it is effectively pitching it back onto people now and saying, well, look, it is up to you. If you want the nice things to happen in July and August, if you want college campuses to reopen in September, then you have to go along with the gradual lifting of restrictions. And there are tough decisions then that have to be taken around, such as the indoor or outdoor. So you kind of sympathise with them in that it is difficult to constantly be modulating your message.
Yeah,
you're sending out the chief medical officer, the deputy chief medical officer, the head of clinical services, and so on across the and the health minister and the previous health minister, and they're all more or less trying to say the same thing in a different manner. So this the latest phase is about this notion of the lockdown is now lifting. We think that's going to be the last one ever, but it's not really our fault if it. If it isn't, it's down to you now at this point, because government has done what it kept up its part of the bargain. Particularly, like, they do have the safety net as well, that once you have vaccinated the vulnerable, that relieves the pressure then on the ICUs.
We hear about breaking the link between cases and hospitalizations, isn't it? I wonder, Anna Rose, Tony O'Brien makes an interesting point in the Business Post today, which is that the speed of the reopening doesn't allow them to assess the effect of various measures, that we should be leaving more time between each one. Do you think that he has a point there?
So each stage allows for about 4 weeks between each stage, and I suppose a lot
with gradual stuff happening over the course of the 4 weeks.
And if we stick by what the current rollout is, I think a lot of the activity in the next phase is very low risk. So it's predominantly focused on increased outdoor activity, which we know is low risk, and that we've learned that over the last year. The landscape has changed. So yes, it might seem a bit quick, and certainly quicker than maybe the stages last year. But remember now, our more vulnerable cohort people are vaccinated. So the, not to say with more wiggle room, but you know, there's more people protected, that it's probably easier then to pull back much quicker if we need to. Okay. But it's not, you know, the restaurants haven't reopened, the higher risk activity hasn't reopened, the indoor activity. So I think to allow 4 weeks for the current stage is probably reasonable. But it's all, this is reviewed every week, the data is looked at, and, you know, be very quick to action that. But I think letting people, I suppose, allowing more personal freedom, I think, over the next 4 weeks is really important for people. And it makes it easier to accept further measures if needed going forward. People can make more sense of them and understand them if they have to, if the situation worsens.
And listen, seeing as we touched on vaccination, so we heard that Pfizer, BioNTech have now applied to the EMA, haven't they, for approval to use their vaccine on children,
yeah,
from 12 up, isn't it, adolescents?
Yeah.
And we see now in the UK that there seems to be possibly some plan to give them one dose of it. Yeah. It's a thing that came up now and again, and then it was like people go, no, don't talk about that, which is the fact that we want to get to this magic place of herd immunity, but that we are really ruling out 25-30% of the population from being vaccinated already, unless we're doing people under 16, aren't we? So can we get to herd immunity without vaccinating children?
So again, it's what we know about the epidemiology of this virus, and it's slightly different, say, to influenza or other coronaviruses. So your standard, your cold viruses in children, where children are high transmitters and they're, they, you know, they're high, they get high rates of infection. It's somewhat different with COVID, and for various reasons, be some biological or epidemiological, the children aren't getting high levels of infection, and they don't seem to be high transmitters of infection to other people. So it's still more important that we roll it out in those higher risk groups. That always still stands, that principle, and work down. And I suppose it'll be borne out in the numbers over the next few months, whether or not, even without children being protected, I suppose it's hard to tell until we get there. But at the moment, certainly for children who are getting infected, most of the infection episodes are happening in the household. So children are acquiring infection from adults. There's not outbreaks in school, for the most part, tend to be quite small numbers, less than, you know, 8 or 10. So the herd immunity concept is obviously very, very important. But having children excluded from vaccination may not be as difficult as it may seem, but again, it'll be borne out, and you know, that'll depend again on variants if they change, and a requirement for children might need to be pushed forward then. But I think we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, Fiona, would you agree with Professor Molly Byrne's assertion that the vaccine rollout is going well?
Well, on the plus side, it does take away that complete nervousness about the hospital system being overwhelmed any day now, and so we all need to be on red alert continually. Ultimately, we are tied in with the EU system in terms of supply, and you'd actually question, given the difficulties that we have in this country with anything that involves logistics, would we have been able to handle a faster rollout?
But listen, are we going to be able to handle what we got this week? Which, did we not hear we got 185,000 of Pfizer, the biggest ever, and we got 175,000 AstraZeneca or something? So I think, no, I'm open to correction, I don't know the exact, but I think we got in excess of 300,000 doses this week. We're not going to give them out next week.
No, and you're probably going to have to get to a bit, in order to hit the schedules, you're going to have to hit a pace where you're giving out about 400,000 of them a week. So by that point, you're expecting that the pharmacists will be fully involved, the GPs will be administering to a wider number of people, and then you're going to have greater number of mass vaccination centres across the country as well. So that is going to be
a test for us. Confidence in your political sources about this 80% that the Minister for Health and the Taoiseach seem to be watering down slightly, but sticking with that 80% by June 1st dose, which will involve, and the Taoiseach said this in the Dáil last week, didn't he, that yes, he feels there could be 450,000 a week being given out by June.
Yeah.
Is there confidence there now?
The confidence seems to be now that, look, the supply line issue has to a degree been resolved. You know, you're pending the next report that says there's a blood clot problem or something like that with a vaccine. But that for now they are that bit more confident of what's actually going to come in. So therefore your planning can be more consistent, and you're not constantly telling people that, look, we'll be giving this cohort the vaccine in the next fortnight, and then having to pull back from that because the vaccine doesn't turn up. So the machine has taken time to ramp up. It's
a slow ramp up, but it's ramping up.
But it does help when you actually have the supply that is coming in into the system. And I think at this point, you know, they can still add a couple of caveats there. They can say, look, the supply was inconsistent for a couple of weeks. We had a difficulty with a rollout in a particular area, a particular sector of society. There was a question mark there. Yeah. Or within a geographical area, there was an issue.
Look, the test will be from here on in when supply no longer is the issue. And now it's down to them, really.
I don't think if we hit 79 or 78% that anybody's going to be given out to them.
Anna Rose, Richard, I'll come back to you in a minute. Anna Rose, can I just ask you about the particular conundrum that the HSE are grappling with before next week, which is this issue of we are not going to have most of the Johnson & Johnson until June. It would be best to give that to the 50 to 60 age group because the AstraZeneca is being used for the over 60s. So do we make them wait? Do we go ahead with a younger cohort? What would you do in that situation?
So I think I would continue with the current strategy, still vaccinate by age group because we know they're higher risk. And as availability of vaccine comes up, you know, the Johnson & Johnson is a very effective vaccine and it's very safe and they're very rare side effects. So as an over 50-year-old, I think I absolutely administer
it. Yeah, but would you wait? Should the over 50s wait until June to get it? Or if we go with the over 50s next and we start giving them Pfizer and I think we can give them AstraZeneca, we can give them any vaccine, right? But are we going to be left with a load of Johnson & Johnson in June that you can't give to anyone under 50? So,
yeah, you know, and that situation might change based on the evidence that comes out around Johnson & Johnson and reviewed by the EMA. So by June, the situation, we may be under 50.
So we're already under pressure on their last decision on it. They could be under pressure again to bring it down to 40.
Know, it's such a huge rollout and, you know, evidence is constantly being acquired. So it is, for the most part, it's very safe. The side effects are very, very rare, but we know they seem to be more common in younger people. But even at that, they're very rare. So I think as more evidence accumulates, we might be more confident in the ability to get to younger
people. They might just take a chance now on going ahead with the
50s. And I wouldn't even say taking a chance.
I mean that they might take a chance that the Johnson & Johnson would be used in the end.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, I think the main reason why a lot of people are getting vaccinated, apart from their own personal safety, Richard, is that they want to get the benefits of vaccination, the so-called bonus. So the suggestion now in the Business Post today about that in order to, say, eat indoors in your cafe, somebody would have to show their vaccine passport. What do you reckon about that? Is it workable? Would it make you happier to be reopened under those circumstances?
I can see the fake ones being sold on Dundeal already. Yeah. But I think it just, as soon as you get into something like that on a day-to-day thing of eating in a restaurant, I think it's almost impossible because our society has just become all about just popping into a place, popping out, popping in, popping out. Whereas it would work perfectly for foreign travel when you're booking an airline flight and you're able to show that you can travel safely. But this idea of having to check people at the door to see whether they had a vaccine passport would be complicated.
Yeah. It seems what happened in Israel is that basically once a kind of a critical mass of people had them, they stopped checking. But what they're saying in Israel is that the vaccine green card served its purpose because what it did was young people didn't want to be vaccinated. They all got vaccinated because they wanted their green card. But now it seems to be that it's used less and less. Now, Richard mentions air travel there. And of course, somebody sets off a frenzy every week about foreign holidays. And it was the Taoiseach this week who suggested that we could be going abroad by July. There is actually another government minister unnamed in the Mail today saying, listen, people will be able to go abroad by June. The vaccine passports will be in and there's no appetite to extend the mandatory hotel quarantine. I think it's due to lapse at some stage at the start of June. We'll see about that at the time, I'd say. But Owen Carey, editor of Air and Travel magazine, is on the line now. Owen, was that frenzy of booking real? Did we see people booking foreign holidays this week in July?
We did see a little bit, but nothing the like we saw in Britain when Boris Johnson made a similar signal about 3 weeks ago. Probably from the Taoiseach does not a summer make, Brendan.
And listen, in terms of, can you explain to us in plain English what's going on here in terms of the EU system and then how Ireland dovetails into that or what choices we have within it or whatever?
I'll do my best. The EU have implemented this very, very speedily. Nothing happens, in my memory, at this pace at the EU level, EU Commission level, as what happened with the Green Digital Certificate. Governments don't like it being called passports, but it's been called passport in popular culture. The EU Parliament passed it this week. But the big proviso, and it's been there from the beginning, is each of the 27 member states must now decide how they are going to relate to that and how they're going to implement it. Ireland hasn't been really quick on international travel. They've been one of the slower movers. And up till recently, we were in the business of shutting it down rather than egging it up again. So it does. I do expect things to move a little bit faster across Europe than in Ireland. And as you might expect, Brendan, Southern Europe, economies such as Spain, Portugal, Greece, Italy, have been much more enthusiastic from the beginning.
I saw in Greece that they will take one dose of Sputnik is enough to get you into Greece. That's how keen Greece are to have everyone in. So listen, so this begs a few questions then. The aviation industry here, Ryanair, etc., holiday flights, are they all ready to go or has that capability been dismantled slightly?
Absolutely ready to go. The one interesting thing is that the aviation industry kept its shape. The inventory is full. If you look into your booking system, you can see extraordinary things. You can see full frequencies there for July, for Malaga, Faroe. There are trunk routes. Most Irish holidays take place to two countries. There's a lot in the marketplace, but almost everybody ends up back in Spain and Portugal. But we've new routes, Brendan. We've four new routes we didn't have in 2019. That's how ambitious the schedule is. We also have those long-haul flights. We've lost maybe a few of them. Minneapolis is gone, Miami is gone, but Orlando is still there, San Francisco, Los Angeles, all still there. And bear in mind that long haul will be slower to recover than short haul, especially within the EU. The sort of optimism we're hearing the last few days is based on flights within the EU. The inventory's okay. In place. Wait, what I've seen is it being pushed back a fortnight at a time.
And no, the thing is, we're looking at the green list that's coming out in the UK, where they can all take off on their holidays on May 17th, I think. The green list is very limited there. It's not just about are we allowed out of Ireland. It's going to be like when we're coming back from these countries to Ireland, are you going to have to stay at home for 2 weeks or whatever? So are we going to have much of a choice about where to go, do you reckon?
I think we'll be very different from Britain. We've less in common with Britain than we had before January the 1st. So we will probably end up with free travel where we can go outwards. The question on the return is that we are still requiring 72 hours. As we sit here this morning, you need a negative PCR test for countries that you're arriving from. And obviously, there's some countries on the mandatory hotel quarantine list. It remains to be seen if our politicians can start dismantling that or start deciding that self-isolation that has been there since last summer and people have stuck to it.
It wasn't effective last summer, Owen. Jesus, sure, we practically had the thing gone and didn't everyone bring it back from Spain? Paddy Mallon did the science on it, and it does seem that what we got here last winter initially anyway before the UK came was from Spain and other places, wasn't it?
I would disagree, and that would be a separate debate we could spend the morning on.
Okay.
But the data shows very few imported cases internationally, and we do reflect the international data. But you are right. Once something starts spreading internationally, it is very, very difficult to keep it out. It's very difficult to keep it out of a nursing home, never mind a country.
Okay. One quick question before you go. A texter here, and I think a lot of people have this at the backs of their minds now as maybe a plan B. What's the position on holidays in the UK?
holidays in the UK remain exactly where they were. We can go there without self-isolation or requiring a test, but you require the test on return, and self-isolation is the requirement there.
Okay, so still not exactly as handy as it might be to go there. Okay, all right, Owen Carey, thanks a million. And sure, look, we'll be talking to you again as this develops, no doubt. Can I ask the panel, any of you thinking of going on a foreign holiday this year?
No.
I can see an issue arising now in the middle of June. When this proposal was being set up at EU level, the Irish position was that the digital green certificate shouldn't come in until the autumn. And we weren't the only country. Germany was in there. Obviously, the southern European countries were pushing it to come in fast. And there seems to be a logistical problem again in Ireland with the rollout of a system. So come the middle of June, people are going to be clamouring, I want my digital green certificate. This is EU law. And there might again be a problem.
Okay. Another row. Yeah.
Just can I jump in on that one as well?
Yeah.
Just have absolutely no intention of going on holiday because I'm going to be working for the summer and happy to be. But let's not forget as well that when this certificate comes in, every flight is bringing people into the country, which is going to keep the economy alive. There's no way our hotels are going to survive without tourists when it's safe to do it.
Yeah, okay, so we need to open up for tourism again is the point you're making, Richard, right, when it's safe, obviously. And Rose, just before we leave this, I don't want to be kind of obscene about it either, and us sitting here talking about whether we'll have a foreign holiday or not. It's starting to strike me that are we looking at a period for the next number of years where the world is going to be incredibly divided? I heard the Australian ambassador to Washington saying, well, we're not opening up Australia and the whole world is vaccinated probably. He said, as tough as it is, these measures are very popular at home, right? They've locked themselves off. Does it look increasingly as if Europe is locking itself down and we're just going to basically split ourselves off from the third world while they spend years getting vaccinated?
So this is the challenge, isn't it? I mean, this is a global infection. It's all well and good any country viewing themselves as an island and controlling what goes on that island and thinking we're fine. But, you know, there's obviously the variations in the world, you know, the rich from the poor. And that's, you know, that's really important as well. If you look at India, they are the highest producer of vaccinations in the world. But look what's going on there at the moment and they can't get vaccinated. So there is this balance. So it's, you know, it's not just about looking after ourselves, but it's about how we look after everybody in order to progress. And you don't want to end up in a situation where you have a divided world where, you know, we can travel within Europe, but forget everybody else. And never mind what's going on in India, because we're fine. So but that will be the situation. I think we'll live it for a couple of years, certainly to some extent. And how we manage that, I suppose, is going to be very challenging. Yeah. And what our outlook is in terms of how we view travel and just various, you know, disparity throughout the world.
Yeah, that could be one of the biggest geopolitical forces we see in the next 5 years, couldn't it? Okay, we'll take a break. Our panel staying with us, Richard Jacob, Dr. Anna Rose Pryor, and Fionnán Sheehan.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Richard Jacob of the Idaho Cafe in Cork, Dr. Anna Rose Pryor, consultant microbiologist, and Fionnán Sheehan, Ireland editor with the Irish Independent. Some texters not as positive as the government, I don't think. One texter saying there, if we all found the third lockdown difficult, just wait for the fourth. Someone else saying people take their cues from the government. If the public think it's all over, it's because they were led to think that way. I don't think quite. I think there was a bit of jubilation early in the week, and then I think Dr. Tony came in hard on Friday and reminded us all of a few home truths as well. So anyway, let's get away from that now. There's refreshing green shoots of what you might call the old politics and things we used to talk about, Fionnán, which is that we have an absolutely stellar, colourful by-election in the offing in Dublin Bay South. Talk us through some of the runners and riders, and this has impact for all the party leaders, really, doesn't it? There's a bigger picture here.
Yeah, it's the only vote we'll have this year. It's the only picture we'll have of any sort of public mood. Not that the voters of Dublin based out are necessarily representative of the nation as a whole. Far from it. That we will get since the general election and the pandemic. And obviously, since the general election, we saw big changes as a result of the pandemic. Fine Gael's recovery in the polls, Sinn Féin stabilising their position, and Fianna Fáil's dropping off, and the smaller parties kind of struggling to get a look in. So we now have got this by-election, and actually there'll be two by-elections in effect, because the selection process is going to be as fascinating as anything else.
Yes.
The within each of the parties, you're within each of the major parties, you're seeing a big. A big struggle
going on. It's a civil
war.
The three government parties, there's a slight civil war.
You were discussing yesterday how people have been forced out of politics. There's no shortage of people trying to run in this by-election. So you take the Greens, you've got an Eamon Ryan loyalist, Claire Byrne, long-serving, really capable councillor, versus Hazel Chew, again, very, very capable. She's the Lord Mayor, but she's seen to be the rebel force.
Profile.
So there's a clash. There within Sinn Féin.
So this will be down to local selection committees,
yeah.
But presumably they listen to what they're being told from above. Eamon Ryan is going to be trying to impose Claire Byrne there, presumably.
Yeah, she's very much, she's worked for Eamon over the course of the last decade, going back to when he was last in government. So would seem to be part of the Ryan camp, as opposed to the other camp within the Green Party, who Hazel Chew would
represent.
And so
it causes a lot
represent.
Of trouble if Hazel Chew doesn't get her day at the polls.
It makes it interesting then, and there have been all sorts of speculation about Hazel Chew joining other parties in recent times as well. So does that come to a head?
Okay.
Likewise within Sinn Féin, do they run Lynn Boylan, who is probably top of the list of people who should be a TD, because if they'd run her in any one of a half dozen constituencies last year, she would have been comfortably elected. She's the former MEP, she's now a senator. There was talk previously about her running in Dublin Bay South, then there wasn't, now there is again, now there isn't again. So there's a question mark there. Does that cause an internal difficulty, because Chris Andrews is a sitting TD? Does he want somebody that high profile in there on top of him?
Okay.
Because there isn't two Sinn Féin seats there for them at the next general election, so one of them would ultimately lose out if they're running. Most intriguingly of all is the Fine Gael battle, and this is Leo Varadkar camp, Owen Murphy camp, versus the anti-Leo Varadkar camp. So you have got Kate O'Connell, the former Fine Gael TD. Even on Fine Gael's worst day in three quarters of a century, nearly held on to her seat. They got nearly 1.5 quotas there. She was basically down by about a 500 vote swing would have got her in across the line, even on that bad day. So she came very, very close. Very outspoken against Leo Varadkar, even up till recently in this studio, only 3-4 weeks ago, where she passed some comments about Leo Varadkar not delivering for Fine Gael, which didn't go down very well. So she is speculated upon as being interested in running for the seat. However, there is an opponent there. James Gagan, great-grandfather, was a Cumann na Gael TD. Grandfather was a Fine Gael TD and a Chief Justice. Both his parents were Supreme Court judges. And his grandfather on his father's side was also a Fianna Fáil TD and minister, which I know he didn't mention that to the local organisation. So very much, blue blood. If you thought Owen Murphy was posh, wait till you get a load of this guy.
And I see he's put a lovely picture of himself and his family this weekend
lovely,
as well.
Qualified barrister. He's been outspoken as well on Dublin City Council since he's gone on there. Quite critical of left-wing parties opposing housing projects. So he has been aligned with the Owen Murphy style thinking.
Yeah.
The word on the Balls Bridge grapevine, and that's obviously a more upmarket grapevine than you normally get as a Chablis rather than a Chardonnay, is that not everybody was entirely surprised within the Fine Gael organisation by Owen Murphy's departure, and that the James Gagan camp has got a jump on the Kate O'Connell camp.
They're ready.
So there is now a question mark over whether Kate O'Connell will run at all, or is James Gagan going to get the run. Fine Gael have to win this seat regardless. Anything other than a Fine Gael defeat or victory is a big shock.
Okay, so look, that there's and Fianna Fáil have their own issues around it, where Jim O'Callaghan wants to win it, but doesn't want to win it. I do see him saying he expects to be the director of elections for it and all that. Whether that's
it's a test for Jim to show that he can do more than just Zoom meetings and make nice speeches at Oxford and Cambridge, and that he actually has got an organisational savvy and can deliver upon the ground if he is going to be the next leader of the party.
Okay, so that's going to be fascinating to watch all that play out. Also, a lot of conniptions going on in politics north of the border. And Eamon Malley's on the line, author and journalist. Eamon, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So, look, Arlene Foster stepping down as leader of the DUP was one thing, but then she kept talking afterwards and then we heard she was leaving the party altogether. What's your read on the whole situation?
Well, it's classic DUP. It's a rerun precisely of what they did to Ian Paisley Sr. This was a surgical coup. You have no idea the forensic nature of this takeout of Arlene Foster. It's been going on for so long, and yet it was beneath the radar, and so many people seem to be unaware of it, but it was being hatched as far back as 6 months ago. And basically, there's this thesis that Arlene Foster was bringing the party to the left. It's hard to believe that anyone would think that there's anyone who is leaning to the left in the Democratic Unionist Party. But effectively, that's the contention, that she was leaning too much to the left. She was perceived to have been soft initially on the protocol and the Irish border, the border of the Irish Sea, and that militated against her. And she wanted to abstain, and she wanted the party to abstain on the Ulster Unionist ban on gay conversion therapy, and they defied her on that. So effectively, the sins against her were perceived to be cumulative, and flowing from that, they decided that's it. She has to go.
And Eamon, so is it? I know there are various fault lines here, and the fault lines in Northern Ireland are more complicated than they used to be. Is it as simple as the if you can say Arlene Foster representing a progressive side of the DUP, is it as simple as it's being portrayed as the DUP wanting to go back into the trenches of more hardline, the creationism and so on?
Well, the reality is this, Brendan. Those who are gravitating towards Edwin Poots are of that disposition, and they feel that where he stands resonates with them. Now, we want to be careful here. There is, whilst Edwin Poots' team believe they have it bagged, they believe that they've got the numbers. Now, those numbers are literally commitments on a sheet of paper, oral commitments given in most cases on a sheet of paper. But I recall very vividly when John Taylor thought he had the Ulster Unionist leadership bagged in the Ulster Hall all those years ago. And David Trimble, out of nowhere, came up on the rails and snatched the leadership from under his nose. So whilst it looks as if Poots has enough to get him over the line, there are 37 members in the Electoral College. He needs 18 votes. It would appear that he has those votes at this point in time. But if it's a secret vote, who knows how people will vote in a secret vote? But
and listen, is there an issue here?
The DUP is done.
And Eamon, is there an issue here as well that Geoffrey Donaldson, he can't be First Minister right now because he's in Westminster, isn't that right? So Poots is the only one of the two who could be First Minister.
Yes. No, Poots doesn't want to be First Minister.
Oh.
The pitch that Poots has made, to the MLAs, to the fellow assembly members, is the party needs to be reformed, reconfigured. There's so much work to be done at party level. He thinks you cannot carry the can as First Minister and be party leader. So this is his approach, and I think it's winning support. So the way he envisages the situation was he will not become First Minister. He and the Assembly Party will, in fact, choose a First Minister. And then that First Minister will be nominated, and Sinn Féin will then, Sinn Féin has a choice to nominate a Deputy First Minister. Now, there's all sorts of speculation that the Sinn Féin will not nominate unless they have a guarantee on the Irish language and other issues. But that's not the way it has been done historically. Even with Martin McGuinness coming into power with Ian Paisley, stipulations were not put down by the DUP and said, unless Sinn Féin do this, we will not form government. But anyway, the bottom line is, if this is a secret vote, it's not guaranteed that Edwin Poots will win it. Geoffrey Donaldson would have to resign his Westminster seat if he were to run, become party leader and want to be First Minister. He cannot be First Minister and be an MP at the same time.
Okay, but he potentially comes back to be First Minister and isn't First Minister for very long then as well. Is that would be right, wouldn't it?
Well, you see, there's a problem here. If Geoffrey Donaldson stood down, if he gave up his Westminster seat in Lagan Valley, his majority was cut from 13,000, 14,000 to 6,000 in the last election. There's a very able girl called Soraka Eastwood of the Alliance Party in that constituency, and she has been there day and night working her socks off. So she's a big challenger. So the Democratic Unionist Party are very worried that should Geoffrey choose to run for the leadership and become First Minister, that the winning of his seat isn't guaranteed by the DUP. That okay. They could have a rerun of North Belfast in Lagan okay. Valley. Just as John Finucane took the seat in North Belfast, the Alliance could take the seat in Lagan Valley. That would be disastrous for the DUP.
OK, and we'll be coming back to this again and again, I'm sure, over the next while. Thank you very much, Eamon Malley. Fionnán, just briefly, I'm late for the news, but the poll you've been running in The Independent over the last 2 days, what are you the key takeaways here? It seems that people want, in their hearts they want it, in their heads not so sure about a United Ireland.
Patriotism versus pragmatism. Yes, people want a united Ireland, but there are all sorts of question marks about, okay, well, what happens next? When should the border poll be? Potentially in the next 5 years. Are you willing to pay more taxes as a result of unification? No. Do you think there might be a return to violence as a result of united Ireland? Yes. And so on across the line. A big issue that's popping up in the north is affinity to the NHS and concerns about the HSE. So it's digging below the surface of just that binary question of are you in favour of United Ireland
okay.
and raising the questions about, well, what happens the next day? Because as we saw with the Brexit vote, that's what happened. They got their result and they had no idea what to do with it.
So these are the things that could all be aired in respective campaigns about this and they certainly kind of present a more complicated picture.
And they're the questions that arise then after yeah. the event. You can't just turn around and say, well, right, we have United Ireland now. Sure, okay. Let's give them 40 TDs up the north and we can all continue on.
Okay, all right, got to go. Fionnán Sheehan, thank you very much. Dr. Anna Rose Pryor, thank you. And Richard Jacob down in Cork, thank you.